Tov, we're doing the Sefer HaMidot, we're up to page Shin Mem Aleph, Shar HaSin'ah. You guys have it? Okay. The Magen Midovna had described seven approaches to containing one's anger. The first approach, he said, was pride, where a person says to himself, I'm not going to answer him. Right? And he said that's a tool, but obviously that's not the best of tools. The second reason, asiba shenit. So he said that's a chokhma, that's wisdom. Ki hachacham b'shom'ot lunot mechalfo ki rabu. A wise person, when he hears someone making a myriad of complaints against him, utziteuhu chol ha'ashivo, and then the natural inclination is to answer. When someone comes and tells you you did A and B and C and D wrong, the natural inclination is to answer. Yomar l'nafsho, an intelligent person tells himself, "Alo pri tshuvati yelaknit et chaveri ulvazoto." What will happen if I answer him? I'll fight him back. I'll shame him. Shenit. So that's the first point I'd be making if I'd answer in defense. Secondly, let's diket nafshi. What would be the purpose of my rebutting his claim? To vindicate myself, ularim karni neged zikne ami, to show everyone, even the elders, that I'm okay. Im kenefo mali latif niv svatai lashivo. So then, why should I answer him? I shouldn't be putting him down. I shouldn't be so concerned to put me up. Halokol asher ani tzich lifol bidvrei fi, efal b'shtikati. Whatever I intend to accomplish by answering him, I can accomplish the same thing by being silent. Be'en machso kol davar, and then I've lost nothing. If I want to get him upset, so he's cursing me out. There's nothing more painful to someone who curses you out than you being silent. Because if someone hears and is silent, that really bothers the guy who is cursing him out. Because what he's basically saying is that the guy who was talking is not worth a response. He doesn't even feel like he has to answer the other person's dreams and his claims. Because he finds the one who's speaking so lowly that he doesn't think he has to answer. So an intelligent person tells himself, wait, I don't have to get angry. What do I want to accomplish? I want to put him back in his place. If I don't respond, that's the harshest putting him back in his place. Shenit, letzdik nafsho neged ha-shomim. Secondly, I want the people listening to think I'm in the right. Halo yitzdiku oto ha-shomim. V'yalelu ata alachat sheva. Who says I'll win? Maybe they'll side with him. If I answer him back, and I seem to win the argument, so then people will say, ooh, the guy who began by cursing me out, he must be such a refined person, he didn't bother answering him. And they'll assume that he's so smart, that's why he didn't answer me. So maybe I should answer him to curse him out so that people will realize how downtrodden he is. So he says to himself, I don't have to say anything. You know, anyone who heard him already realizes what type of person he is, so why do I have to answer him? He already made his shame known to everyone. Because that's what happens when someone tries cursing someone else out. So then, the person in essence is indicating about himself double what he's indicating about the other person. When someone stands up and curses someone out, so an intelligent listener will automatically think, wait a second, the guy talking, what's he really worth if this is what he's saying? Cursing someone out is only pleasant to the person himself who's cursing at the moment of anger. When a person's angry, at that moment, it feels good to curse someone out. But the listener, he doesn't share the emotion. So when we hear someone yell, we don't side with them. Think about it. You're sitting in a room, And one guy, let's say, Chaim turns to Shimon. And he starts cursing him out. You dirty scumbag. What are you doing here? I can't believe you're even here. You're the filth of the earth. And you're sitting there. You're uncomfortable listening to that. You're uncomfortable by the guy who's doing the cursing because you don't share the emotion. Whoever's listening doesn't find it pleasant. Whoever isn't angry will look down at the one doing the cursing. It's like being drunk. A person who's drunk enjoys what he's doing as he's being drunk. But the onlookers don't see any charm in it. So a person who's slightly intelligent says, why should I bother answering? He's already said everything I have to say. Shame, he's shamed himself to show that I'm right. Anyone with half a brain already understands I'm right. What do I have to answer him for? So it's like a person who sees a stone that's burning hot in the fire and he wants to throw it at his friend. So he sticks his hand into the fire and grabs the stone that's white from heat to throw it at his friend. Who gets burned first? The guy wants to throw it, right? As a Yisurin kodmin oto milachavero. The guy who wants to throw the burning hot stone, well, he's hurting himself before he can even attempt to hurt his friend. As King Solomon, peace be upon him, as he said, Baz l'reu chasar lev, he who mocks his friend lacks intelligent, v'ish tvunot yacharish, and someone who has understanding will remain silent in the face of someone mocking him. King Solomon told us that when someone mocks someone else, curses someone else out, that's really a big shame to the one who's doing the cursing. Because someone who tries to mock other people, what really comes out of it is that they mock themselves. An intelligent person is silent. Why should an intelligent person talk? Anything you answer is actually just going to detract. Because without answering, people will respect him just because he's silent, because he doesn't feel like he has to answer. And on the contrary, the guy who cursed him out, he showed his shame. Okay, so that's the second approach. When a person starts seeing they're getting angry, someone curses them out, they want to answer. So the second approach he's describing is the approach of wisdom, where a person thinks to himself, what will I gain? What will I lose? Will I gain more or lose more if I respond? And the answer is almost always, you lose more. It's almost always that by answering, you will lose more. There are exceptions. This is not an absolute rule. There are times where if you don't stand up for yourself, no one else will, and no one will know that you're in the right. There are times where if you're silent, then it will be taken as a recognition that you're wrong. Sometimes you can say something and someone can make you look really bad. I had two stories. Story number one happened numerous times as I was teaching. The first time was the first year I was teaching. Next door to my classroom was an old teacher who was very bitter. And I was teaching 7th or 8th grade. Part of the class, to keep the guys focused, I would pause every 15, 20 minutes and have them do jumping jacks, run around the room, throw a ball. We'd play games. This was a 7th or 8th grade class. And after every 20 minutes to half hour, I'd see they couldn't focus anymore, so I couldn't give them recess every time. So inside the class, we'd play games. So one time, the game we played was where all the kids in the class would line up in the back of the classroom. Everyone has their arms folded. And I throw the ball. And I fake throwing the ball. And if you open your hands, when I didn't throw the ball, you lost. And if I threw the ball and you didn't catch it, you also lost, right? So that's the game, right? You do this, one or the other. Now, what I didn't realize was they're all lining up against the wall of this angry teacher next door, right? So here we are. I'm throwing the ball. I'm faking I'm throwing the ball. And you could understand the kids were having a blast, and every so often the ball would hit the wall. And just my luck, this teacher walks in just as I'm standing there with the ball facing his wall, right? And he walks in and he looks at me. Now you got to figure, I'm the new guy on the block, right? I'm the new teacher here. He sees me in front of the class and I'm with the ball. So that didn't stop him. He started yelling not only at the class, but at me too. Like, what do you guys think this is? And where do you think you are? And who do you think you are? And he's going on for 5 minutes about how we all have no respect. Okay, now what do you answer? So half these kids had him already as their teacher. So I didn't think it was right I should answer. So I just said, you know, I'm very sorry. I should have thought of it, that it could disturb your classroom, and I apologize. And we'll see to it not to do it again. So that's example number one, where sometimes you're in a scenario where the right thing is apologize. You might not have been wrong. Could be the other guy was wrong. Could be you're teaching these kids who he taught and they're still illiterate. The kids happen to be literally illiterate. Think about it. They went through his class. They reached me in eighth grade. They didn't know how to read. So that says something about the success of his method. When I was done with them, they were each accepted into high school, so they knew how to read and learn. So you can't argue with success. But okay, that doesn't matter. You know, in their eyes, he's the rabbi. What am I supposed to do? So fine. You know, I accepted everything he said. I didn't argue. I apologized. Gamarnu. Sometimes that's strategy number one. Strategy number two. I'm giving a class, and someone in the audience starts... this was a person who was not traditional, to put it mildly. And he decided he's going to start arguing with me. So the topic was... okay, it doesn't matter what the topic was. So... he says, okay, Rabbi, I have a question. Okay, I didn't know what was coming. So he says, how can you say what you said? The verse says, and he quotes a saying. And how can you say what you said? The Mishnah says, and he quotes a Mishnah. And how can you say what you said? He quotes a halacha. So I said, okay, three mistakes, you're out. He said, what do you mean? I said, the first thing you quoted, there's no such pasuk. It's a saying. It doesn't exist as a pasuk. There isn't such a pasuk. The second thing you said is a Mishnah that's not the version we have and that's not the version we rule with. It's a far-out version that someone quotes. Okay, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it has nothing to do with the halachas we're discussing. And the third thing you quoted, well, that's totally off. That's just wrong. So there's nothing to talk about. All your bases are gone. So please don't bother the class again. Okay, now, what was the point? The second I saw the agenda and what he was saying, so I didn't think it was right to sit there quietly, because what ends up happening is that all the listeners are thinking, oh, there are two legitimate opinions. The rabbi was presenting one, and this guy, no, he's also presenting one. So sometimes you can't be silent. I'm saying it's not always a correct formula to say everyone's going to figure out that he's wrong. No, not necessarily. 2-3 weeks ago, I was giving a class on the laws of Lashon Hara, and someone raised their hand and said, "That's a takana shena tzibur yochel lamod bo. For generations, no one can stand up. Now, you see, no one can keep it." So I wanted to be respectful because it's someone much older than me, but I said, "You know, I'm very sorry, but you said takana shena tzibur yochel lamod bo. That's a halachic concept about a rabbinic institution. If the rabbis make an institution, one of the gauges we have for the institution is, can the masses stand up to it or not? I'm sorry, but I think it's a grave error to apply that to the mitzvah of the Torah. You took a concept that's relevant to a rabbinic institution, and now you want to decide which mitzvahs in the Torah the masses can keep or not? I didn't want to tell him, but that's heretical. That's just not, that's a non-observant approach. That's not orthodoxy. For us to rule out a mitzvah in Torah and say, the masses can't stand up, that doesn't exist in Orthodox Judaism. There's no such concept. It's true that when the rabbis made a rabbinic institution, so then one of the gauges they would make, a built-in gauge, was to see, will the masses live up to it over time? And sometimes they said, we take it back. We say the masses couldn't do this. And that's quoted in Halacha. So here the guy's trying to refute something we're learning, and he's bringing up something that's totally corrupt, that has nothing to do with the concept. I'm saying the formula that he's giving us here is an important formula. It's not always the correct formula. He himself will show that this isn't the ideal formula. I'm just saying this is a positive tool, sometimes to be used, not always. Sometimes it's wrong to be silent. Sometimes you have to answer. Okay, I'll give you one more example. Usually I don't like arguing with people. I was on a plane a number of years ago, and the people start putting on their tefillin. I never like bothering people with davening, where it'll bother people, where it'll bother the waitresses, where it'll wake up people, where the noise will bother people. So I wasn't going to that minyan right then. And I'm still sitting in my seat, and there are three of us. Me, a fellow who I didn't know at that time, and in the window seat is a kid, a young kid who had just been to Israel on birthright. He didn't know too much about Judaism, but he was all inspired and excited. So I'm sitting there, and I overhear the guy sitting in between us telling him that he's also a Jew. He's just a Jew for Jesus. And he says, you know what? Let me tell you what Judaism is really about. Now, I'm still sitting there in my seat. So the guy turns to him and he says, you see all those quacks? They're putting on their flag, whatever they call that. That has nothing to do with Judaism. So I said, excuse me, can you just tell me? You said you're also a Jew, right? He says, sure. I said, fine. You believe in the Bible? He said, yes. I said, well, the Bible says to wear those. Why don't you? So he says, it doesn't say it in the Bible. Now, at that time, I happened to have a Bible on hand. I said, okay, so I'll quote the verse in Hebrew. Do you speak Hebrew? He said, no. I said, so then you don't know what the Bible says. So he said, I know a translated version. I said, okay. So then you should know that it says it in the Bible. I'll read the verse and I'll show you. So now, again, I could have sat quiet. He wasn't talking to me. You don't always have a right to sit quiet. He's trying to mislead someone who's new, fresh, doesn't know too much. Next he says to me, well, if you know the Bible, then you also know that the serpent in the Bible speaks about Jesus. I said, no, I know what it says in the Bible, and he doesn't speak about Jesus. There's no such sentence. So he starts quoting to me from the English version he had learned from. I said, look, you see, that's what happens when you read a translation. In the original text, it doesn't exist. There's no such sentence. Never happened. He never said that. So he didn't know what to say. I said, you know, I'll show you the text. And it doesn't say that. I don't know which translation you learned, but there's no such quote. So the poor guy, you know, he didn't know what to say. I'm just bringing this as an example where you can't always sit quietly. This formula that he's giving us is in general a good formula. He's going to discuss that there are better formulas, but it's not always the correct formula. You can't always sit back and be quiet.